Commander Eppard, Real 21. We've got to the point where you joined HMS Battle Axe in March 1950, taking over early April, I think, your responsibilities, which we briefly discussed. Perhaps we'll come back to that. But the next thing is you went on a summer cruise, which I think I'd like you to tell us what exactly you were doing and a bit about the routine of it.
Well, the Hemfleet, which we belonged to, went on its summer cruise. And so Battle Axe and Crossbow and Broadsword were the three ships in the Hemfleet. The fourth one, Scorpion, doing trials with the weapon Limbo I mentioned before, was not part of the cruise. She was really under the control of the scientists at that stage, doing all the things that they do. So the summer cruise, we went off in the Home Fleet up the west coast of Scotland, up to Lamb Lash, with Theseus, which was an aircraft carrier. And we were working our way up to try and prove that we were no longer shore-based in our thinking. From my personal point of view, having now got two children and having left them behind, it was a matter of extracting myself from that frame of mind where I went to work daily as though it was an office thing and went to sea, to the fact that I was away from home. And the cruise we took part in, first of all, involved activities with the French Navy. And we went off towards Brest. And there were some NATO ships with the force as well. I think one was a Dutchman called the Jacob von Heemskerk, and a Frenchman called La Fantasque. And we berthed at Brest very briefly. And at Brest there was a reminder that the war was not long past, because the German submarine shelters there loomed over everything, and one couldn't help thinking of what they'd meant to us only a comparatively short time before. But we had what was called a summer war, which was the way we described the summer activities, and then took part in this exercise activity with the Frenchmen when we went down to Brest.
What exactly were you doing? Do you remember much about the summer exercise?
Not the particular thing. I was mostly concerned that my particular ship and the sixth destroy flotilla did well. And I was also vastly amused that my captain, who was the Captain D of the sixth flotilla, Kay Edden, obviously had friends in the north shore of Invergordon. And every time we went to sea, he turned the ship over to the navigator and spent all his time peering through his binoculars at a particular house on the port side as we went out. And we didn't exactly tease him about it. We knew that there were side references to some lady he knew there. Peggy came up to Invergordon with the children, which added to the fun because we were in harbour there for a little bit, and she stayed with friends at Fort Reyes. And she had really a very, very exciting trip up. It was only for a very few days because we went to sea again. And the object of our next trip to sea was to take Admiral Vian, who was the commander-in-chief, and his cousin, who was a civilian, I think, back to Namsos, where one of his more brave events during the war had taken place. And so we went over there, and all the locals turned out, because he was a very famous man indeed. And the captain spent a certain amount of time brushing the fluff off the Admiral's shoulders as we went up harbour, and then took over the ship at the last moment. And we thumped the jetty on which the band and everybody else were standing and cheering very hard indeed, and rocked them on their feet. So the captain criticized the navigator for not doing his stuff very well. The Admiral Vian said, "Rumpf," very strongly to himself, I noticed. However, he was then entertained ashore, where he was given the biggest salmon I have ever seen in my life, which was brought back and put in the captain's refrigerator. I wanted to have a photograph of this salmon, which was about 30-odd pounds, a really big one. So I persuaded the Captain Stewart, to bring it out into the air on the upper deck as we went down away from where we'd been berthed. And the fish was still very slippery, and it slipped out of his arms and very nearly went over the side. And I knew that would be the end of my naval career, so I fell on it with my uniform, got covered in fish scales. Nobody found out about that event, I'm happy to say. There's a photograph to remind me of it. And at the time, the baby, younger daughter, had been very, very small indeed and brought up in the sleeper from the south. And I was trying to remember all those things as well, and I perhaps wasn't thinking straight. But we went off from there to Trondheim, and in Trondheim we met the mayor, whose name was Solberg, a Norwegian, who was very proud that he was driving the Mercedes, which belonged to the German governor of that area, which was a bulletproof Mercedes. And we introduced to his daughter, who took us and a number of my friends, midnight swimming in the Trondheim Fjord, when the sun was only just on the rim of the horizon at midnight. And it was the coldest water I've ever swum in, ever. The local custom was you didn't wear any clothes at all in order to swim at midnight. So we all undressed, including the mayor's daughter, and I was horrified to find that she had such an awful back problem, although she never took her harness off, although she took everything else off. Sweet girl, who rejoiced in the name of Randi, R-A-N-D-I. Well, we went from there south down to Copenhagen. And in Copenhagen, it was very much a formal visit, and where we called on everybody and took part in all the entertainments. And it really was the most enormous fun. I was made an honorary life member of the Hellerupi Drexler Club, the tennis club there, the equivalent of Wimbledon, and had my pants absolutely taken off by an ex-lady champion of Denmark playing on an indoor court. And I met another family who took me off to Elsinore, Hamlet's castle. The naval bit rather took second place to all these excitements, as you would imagine. But I was hugely impressed by two things. One was I wanted some Copenhagen pottery, china. And in 1950, I thought, you know, the British would be able to buy these sort of things. And I was totally put down by the shop in the middle of Copenhagen, who asked me what currency I intended to buy it in. And when I said pounds, they said, no, they're terribly sorry, there was a year's waiting list for people paying in pounds. So I got a friend to put up money in whatever currency it was, I think Swedish krona or something like that. And we were able to buy a bit of that and bring it home. But it was a great shock to the system to find that we were, although we might have won a war, we hadn't actually won any of the currency battles in that part of the world. The sort of routine that I was following was to play tennis every afternoon at the tennis club with the locals, as there were some other good tennis players in the flagship. And then squash in the evening and have a very late night dancing or whatever with the people at the tennis club, who were extremely generous. It was a very, very lovely cruise, and we were alongside the Langeliney jetty in Copenhagen, which is not terribly far away from the Little Mermaid, which is the famous statue.
So was the whole of the home fleet that was exercising with you, or had you been detached?
Not all of them, no. We split up and went to different ports, and I don't remember which particular ones came with us, except the flagship was there. And I went to dinner in the Tivoli Gardens with the family and found I was sitting at the next table to the King, which I thought was a most unexpected event. It said something about the way they run Denmark at that particular time. So it was fascinating, first of all, to watch my captain's relationship with the Commander-in-Chief. Secondly, to meet, I hadn't been to Norway since I'd been the first ship into Stavanger at the end of the war, and to see how they were sort of getting on. And then to see the still violent anti-German feelings of the mayor at Bergen. And then to come further south and to see little Denmark with a product which they could claim sell all over the world and wanted the best currency if I'd get themselves right. So we came back again and did important things like christening our baby, who was 6 months old by then. And we went down to do that where she'd been born, down in Dorset, which was great fun. And getting the ship sufficient, it had worked up well. I'd learnt more about the ship. It's my first cruise in her, of course. And we were chasing pretend submarines or real submarines of our own, practicing signals, all those sorts of things. And I began to feel I was belonging and that I could do my stuff there. Which got us lined up for an autumn cruise. This is the routine that the Home Fleet was following at that time. And we set off from our home port in Portsmouth. Of course, family had had to move house still again, or try to. And in the end, I found myself commuting to Dorset every night from Portsmouth, which was quite a sweat to start with. But the next cruise, autumn cruise, took us to, first of all, up to Londonderry, which was the Joint Anti-Submarine School. So we had cooperation with the Coastal Command aircraft there and some of the local ships and submarines. And I had a run ashore and went down to the Giant's Causeway and all those sort of interesting places in that part of the world and did some flying. And we then went to Gibraltar. And that really was huge fleet. Lots of admirals, lots of inspections, and no time to think about anything except meeting the next deadline, from my point of view. Occasionally I went ashore in Gibraltar, as I had done during the war from HMS Sheffield at one time, and also again from Tata, which was very reminiscent sort of stuff. But on the way back, we went to La Palice, which is the sort of out harbour of a much older port, a mile or two inland. And there, rather to my surprise, Monsieur André Simon, who was the chairman of Courvoisier, the brandy people at the time, invited a coachload of sailors to come and have lunch with him at the Courvoisier place, and I got through the rather pleasant straw of having to take them there. I thought it was a rather pleasant straw. And in this quite marvellous old buildings on the Charente, I think, down there, we had a superb lunch, and of course brandy, and the sailors liked their brandy very much indeed, and we were shown round how they actually make brandy, which is virtually exactly the same as far as the customers are concerned. But there was one man there with about 100 or 150 bottles of brandy going back over the years of each year that they'd made it, who claimed to be able to tell which year any one bottle contained. And the sailors didn't believe him. They said, go on, prove it. So they blindfolded him, and he proved it. It was the most extraordinary demonstration. He could tell exactly which one it was of the two or three which were chosen at random. And we were shown how they used to make it and how they actually made it now. It really was quite superb. We went on from there, back to Portsmouth, of course, for Christmas leave period. And so once more, Peggy moved the family down in that area from Dorset, in this case, and we stayed with friends outside of Portsmouth before starting the spring cruise of 1951 now. Again with Admiral Philip Barnes, Commander-in-Chief Home Fleet. And we had an American carrier with us, the Franklin D. Roosevelt, for exercise Bear Trap, I think with the 6th Fleet, which was the American fleet in the Mediterranean at that time. Captain Eden was very keen indeed, I think, to be seen to be very efficient, but more importantly, not to be seen to be inefficient at any stage. So we covered occasionally for things which were not quite perfect. But we went on from there to cruise, and we went, among others, to Genoa.
Did you remember much about Bear Trap?
Virtually nothing, except there were submarines, there were carriers, there was everything under the sun. So long as I was able to deploy the ships, if we were the senior officer of the screen, on a screen which worked and none of the submarines penetrated, I was happy.
You went to Genoa.
We went down to Genoa, and that gave me enormous interest because in Sheffield in 1940 or 41, we bombarded Genoa.
You told me that story, you found it, yes.
And so going back there was splendid. And I was also invited, after being up all night at a party, to go up to Milan and go to the opera. I'm not an opera buff, but I was shown around and saw the cathedral and all the places you'll see, and disgraced myself by going to sleep during the opera, I'm afraid, in the best seats there were, which was very embarrassing indeed. But it is the most wonderful place, nothing nautical about it. But of course, on the way back, we went up to Portofino, another gorgeous place where millionaires herd themselves into the lovely houses available there, and also to Villefranche as we went along the coast. And at Villefranche, my ship obtained an invitation from a ski club, French ski club, and would we go up to the chalet at Bailey-Lone up in the mountains. And so, yes, I said, that would be lovely. I'd done a bit of skiing, donkey's ears before, and one of the other officers in the ship had done too. And we took a dozen sailors or thereabouts. And we'd been put into the chalet, which belonged to the ski club. And there wasn't much accommodation, and I shared a room with the other officer. And there was one bed, and there was one orange box with straw in it. And not much else. So I tossed him for it. And I lost, unfortunately. And so I had the orange box on the first night. And, of course, the Frenchmen were going to come up and join us there during the night. And I vaguely remembered, and at last I'd got to sleep in this thoroughly uncomfortable thing. I heard voices, and then the door opened, and a sharply indrawn breath, the door shut again. And then quite suddenly the door opened, the lights were turned on, and they all rushed in and said, voilà les Anglais, corps à corps. And it turned out this other chap had climbed into the bed with me, which was very embarrassing indeed. So there was much raucous laughter in the middle of the night about that, and all the sailors heard about it the next day, which was very embarrassing indeed. But there had been a great deal of snow, and so we had to teach the sailors how to ski. We'd been given skis for them. And because we were having to work our way up the newly made pistes, which were not sort of mechanically generated those days, you trod them down and stamped them down with your skis, I found the sailors, who didn't know how to stop or anything like that, being held round the stomach by one of their friends and pointed downhill. And they say, right, better go. And off they'd go at tremendous speed. And to my horror, I saw one of them going absolutely straight for a pile of logs. And I bellowed at him, fall over, fall over. But he didn't. He hit the pile of logs. And as he shot through the air and disappeared over the other side, head first, I was wondering which form I had to fill in to say that I'd unfortunately lost a sailor skiing somewhere. We went down, and he was sort of digging himself out of the hole. He said, Cor, did you see that, sir? I call that stop the crucified kipper. And he wasn't hurt at all. But it was the most marvellous fun, I must say. French as well. When I got back down to Villefranche, where we were anchored, I found that we had to scrape some of the sea lice and things like that off the Aztec Dam. And so I was also a shallow water diver, and so swimming about underneath, I found in those waters, swimming down by the propellers, I could see all the way up forward to the Aztec Dam and all the way up to where the anchor cable came down. It was perfectly lovely clear water. Well, we had back to Gibraltar, there was the most wonderful opportunity to go and watch bullfighting, which I'd not seen before. A lot of the sailors went over there as well. And an 11-year-old boy, rather surprisingly, was leading the parade of the Toreadors. And he wasn't old enough, we thought, to be doing this sort of thing. Because how was he going to reach over the head of the bull? But he did it by jumping, literally, his feet well off the ground, in order to put his picks in, and then eventually to kill it. And this appealed to the audience so much, they insisted on giving him the ears of the bull, and he was carried on everybody's shoulders all the way around the bull ring. The sailors who went with me didn't like this, and were cheering for the bull the whole time, which didn't make friends with the local Spaniards awfully well, as you would imagine. The sort of thing which the sailors really objected to was the putting fresh sand over all the blood on the sand as the bull was towed out dead afterwards. It was, well, part of the experience again. But it wasn't the end of our... you have to remember that 1951 was the Festival of Britain year, too. And so we did a Festival of Britain cruise as well. The dates of that I don't remember, but it took us up, among other places, to Northumberland and the Lake District. And I found that the just a little way from Leswater, there was a mayor who was very, very fond of some lady there near Whitehaven, where we had to entertain the locals, and they had to entertain us. Well, we could entertain them easily enough, but I found that my entertainment consisted of being proved to be anything but a man by the local coal miners, because the shafts for the coal mining there go out under the sea quite a long way, and because the seams of coal were getting thinner and thinner, eventually you have to hack the coal out with a pickaxe lying on your side in 9 inches of water. And they thought that I would jib at that, and so I was taken out there and spent a certain amount of time lying in the water hacking at coal just to prove that I wasn't jibbing at it, but it was no fun at all. And there was a Royal Naval Air Station just nearby there called Amthorn at that time. And so I duly called on the captain there. I'm not quite certain why I called on the captain there, but I did. And we had a jolly good lunch, and his extremely pretty wife. And then he said, had I ever flown in a Sea Fury? And I said, no, I hadn't, because the Sea Fury is a single-seater aircraft. Oh, he said, I've got a dual Sea Fury. I'll take you up. Well, he'd had a jolly good lunch, and we'd had a certain amount of drink. I was a little anxious about this, but I could hardly tell the captain of a naval air station that he was too tired to fly. So we had a most exciting time, and I did indeed fly a Sea Fury. I think it was very dangerous for both of us, but it was an experience, still another experience in their circumstances. But eventually we went up to Stornoway as well, and Stornoway was another experience, because there... two things happened. One, I think I mentioned before, that the man who'd been my servant in HMS Byron was a Stornorwegian fisherman, and I was eventually able to contact him, and he came on board, and that was marvelous. But because it was an official visit to Whitehead, to Stornoway, we were also taken off to the western part of the island and shown the tweed being made in the original places the tweed was made, outside the back door with hand-driven looms and all the rest of it. Marvellous Harris tweed. And I attended a sheep shearing, which was a village commitment. Everybody turned out for that particular event. And I met the local tweed merchant, who proved to be very keen on fishing. He took me fishing down a little river in a coracle, surprisingly. And when we couldn't take the car any further, we put the coracle in the water and went downstream. He said, the place to be is on these sandbanks just as the tide turns. And as the tide turned, he got out a huge carving knife
put his gumboots on and went into the little waves breaking on the shallow sand and moved the carving knife along with his hand just in front of it until he felt resistance, when he'd quickly move it up. And there he caught these little elbers, eels. And this was what he was looking for, because he then cast those out just beyond where the waves were breaking. And we managed to catch salmon and sea trout, which started to move as soon as they felt the flood tide behind their tails. And in about half an hour, we caught three or four sea trout and a salmon. Very exciting. Again, something I'd never done before. And our next port on this marvelous Festival of Britain cruise was down to Portree on the Isle of Skye. Well, as a cousin, my godfather, first cousin, was a MacLeod, I'd taken the trouble to contact Dame Flora MacLeod of MacLeod and say, would it be possible? We'd love to see the castle. And I'd hired the Peggy was staying in the hotel, and we got in the car, which the hotel manager had lent me because I was allowed to, because of the MacLeod. We were going to lunch at the castle. And it was pouring with rain, as it so often does in the Western Isles. And on the way up there, we passed a little old lady, obviously soaked to the skin, but she was wearing a MacLeod tartan in the heart of nowhere and walking generally in the direction we were going. So I stopped and offered her a lift. And she said, oh, you must be David Ruffard. You're lunching with me. And this was Dame Flora, who took it for granted I would stop on the way over, even though I'd never seen her before in my life. And we had a most marvelous lunch there and eventually went fishing on the Storlocks afterwards with her gilly, which was so rough that Peggy had to be landed in a bog because she was feeling seasick. But the greatest fun, and there was one moment in an evening there when the MacDonalds and the MacLeods actually were speaking to each other, which is a very rare event on Skye, as we found out. But we saw the fairy flag and we did all the things one does under those conditions. I loved it. But after that, we had to go somewhere, and of course the cruise ended, and we went back to Portsmouth. And we still hadn't got anywhere to live. So Peggy again moved house, Brockenhurst, the New Forest, with some friends of ours who were there. And eventually we bought a house in Leon Solent, because I was beginning to know that my next job would be in Portsmouth. It was sweet rationing and things like that still existed. It was not easy from the family points of view, but I knew by then that I was going to be running the next long TAS course for a group of young officers.